NWP Radio.
You're listening to NWP Radio, a production of the National Writing Project.
NWP.
Welcome, listeners. This is NWP Radio, a production of the National Writing Project. Today, we're talking with Writing Project folks from all around the network. I'm your host, Tanya Baker, at the NWP, on location at a resource development retreat in Denver, Colorado. Tonight, we're talking about what we're reading this summer. Before we jump into that, we'll go around and introduce ourselves.
I'm Tom Fox.
I'm Jesse Early from the Central Arizona Writing Project.
I'm Bud Hunt, Colorado State University Writing Project.
I'm Kavodian from Red Cedar Writing Project.
I'm Andrea Katz from San Jose Area Writing Project in California.
And I'm Luke Hokama with the National Writing Project in Berkeley.
Elise Imanadal, National Writing Project, Berkeley.
Thank you all for being here. We've noticed whenever we get together at Writing Project events that people like to talk about what they're reading. So we thought, why not share that with everyone this week? We thought we'd jump in by talking about various categories of reading, and we might start, if people want to, with what is on your professional bookshelf this summer? Anything interesting you're reading about teaching and learning or other areas of our profession?
I'll start. It's more about my most recent find. I worked at a bookstore, and one of the customers came in and told me that I really needed to read On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century by Timothy Snyder. And I looked at it, and it was short, and I had so many airline delays getting here that I read it in a day. So I recommend it as a thoughtful look at how we can responsibly live our lives these days with the current political climate. He looks back at what we can learn from what's happened in the 20th century and how it pertains to what's going on now in terms of things like how we need to defend our institutions that we really care about, how we need to stand out and not wait for others to do it, how we need to believe in truth despite what we're hearing on media sometimes. It really, I really got led by it.
Aram, I love that you brought that book up. You said it was a slender volume. It is. I think if people find it in the bookstore, they'll see that it is truly a pocketbook. So, but it's distilled, as you were saying, it's a set of lessons from a person who was a historian of the 20th century, especially in Eastern Europe, and with a focus on sort of tyranny and authoritarianism. So it's sort of like his lessons as a historian from a previous period that he would then give to us at this particular time. So it's an interesting scholarly book as well as a political book at the same time.
But digestible, because I just Googled the book to grab it and realized that I'd seen it because I work at a library and I walk by the new bookshelf every day. And I grabbed it. It was one of those, like, oh, I have to touch this, and I leafed through it, and, yeah, I wanted to read it, and I forgot.
I think he started with, like, some Medium posts or something like that, and then got a tremendous reception and then was motivated to make it into a book from that. Do you remember, Aram?
That sounds right. He's also had some YouTube videos based on some of the lessons from it, too, that you could search.
Yeah, well, you talked about it as like a professional book. Just like, what connections did you make? I thought that was interesting, and I could agree. I'm just curious.
Well, the ninth chapter is called Be Kind to Our Language, and as a writer and a reader, I think that we need to use the language that we have and not fall into the trap that, I don't know, I guess I would say Fox News or whatever would have us just kind of go for sound bites and narrow thinking, but to kind of expand our hope and our vision for this country, as opposed to just kind of go along step by step, but kind of use our thinking brains and translate that into a language that everybody can get around.
Yeah. Sort of in a politics and the English language, George Orwell kind of way.
Exactly,
yeah.
Which he does bring up in the book, yes.
I had some books that I was going to talk about, too, in the professional category, and I think they're related, they're a kind of different answer to that question, because I have been really, in the last few months, thinking about the role of schools in creating a culture in which tyranny and authoritarianism can take hold. And so I've been trying to read a lot about what we might do to open schools and make them places of where whole humans come together to learn and work and play. So I'm recommending a sort of a set of three books that I've read this spring. One is Carla Shalaby's Troublemakers. The subtitle of that book is Lessons in Freedom from Young Children at School. And in that book, Shalaby there's four case studies of children who've been marked as troublemakers in kindergarten or first grade. And talks about them as though asking us to understand that if children can be marked as troublemakers upon entering school, that maybe the problem is with the institution of school more than with children, and that these children who press against the kind of repressive culture of school are canaries in the coal mine that we should really be paying attention to. And then two books that NWP has co-published in this season are Fred Hamill's Choice and Agency in the Writing Workshop, Developing Engaged Writers, Grades 4 to 6, and Bronwyn LeMay's Personal Narrative Revised, Writing, Love, and Agency in the High School Classroom. And so together I find them a very complementary pair because they each talk at a different grade level about what it means to make space in classrooms for kids to bring their whole selves and bring what they know out from out in the world into the classroom in order to study academic subjects, and about the relationship between the sort of cultural curriculum or the social curriculum that is happening, whether we are paying attention to it or not, and the academic curriculum that we are often trying to push. So. I was really thinking about the idea about thinking that my response to the same trouble that Arm was reading the 20 lessons in response to is to like focus on the place I know best, I guess, in school, and thinking about how can we fight tyranny and authoritarianism in that space.
I was pointing at Jessica because you've been talking like this whole retreat as sort of observations about bringing the whole self to school and to writing, and so that's why I was pointing at you because I thought that you we can cut anything out, don't worry about that, because I thought you might respond to that, those books.
Well, the main thing, I'm like frantically writing them down because I knew about the two that NWP has co-published, and I want to use one of them as this writing note to self in my class in the fall. And then the book about troublemakers sounds so compelling, just thinking about as a parent now, mm-hmm. and going to have lunch with my kids in the cafeteria once a semester, sometimes more, and just seeing like the kids that are pulled aside were clearly labeled as the troublemakers. And a couple times I've gone to the principal to talk about how they're being treated, and it's clearly connected to race and social class and being somehow perceived as different. And from my lens, it's clearly, I can't wait to read that book because it so echoes just that feeling of outrage sitting there with my kids and looking at people who are treated unfairly by the institution because somehow they come to the institution seeming different when the institution is there to serve everyone.
The other thing that I thought was really fascinating about Troublemakers, and you're saying it's just about being with your kids in school, was the way that that we institutionalize the other young people to enact this vision of those kids too. Because not just the institution, it's not just the adults, it's how quickly other children get incorporated into this vision of what is good and what is bad, and what school's for and who school's for, and the way they are used. You know, and I don't mean that teachers are intentionally cruel or meaning to do this, but kids are used to enforce these ways of thinking about kids who are troublemakers.
I thought about in the instant where I was sitting there and watching this in the cafeteria is that if I don't get up and do something, then I am teaching my kids and the kids around me that it's okay to be a bystander. And that's exactly what we're seeing. Like, so I stood up so uncomfortable and went and talked to the adults who were doing what they were doing. But it's hard to be that person who does that.
I saw a Pew study last night that says that 60% of Americans believe that that should happen. The exact quote was, 60% of Americans say that bystanders who witness harassing behavior online should play a major role in addressing it.
Interesting.
So you're in the majority.
Yeah.
Be not afraid.
You're in the majority of believing it, and you're in the minority of acting.
Yeah,
I'm
doing it.
Yeah,
yeah.
I think there's a difference in believing and acting.
Yeah.
But isn't it like a direct connection, which you started with, to on tyranny, in a way?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like there's an example that fits.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I have a really good example of a teacher who resisted. And I don't remember a whole lot of grade school, really, because it wasn't that meaningful to me. But in fifth grade, there were two really poor kids, Brian and Leroy. And they were brothers. And Brian withdrew and Leroy fought. That's how they managed their social life. And I had a teacher, Mr. Baumgartner, who made a point every single day of praising the brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Like noticing when they washed their hands and when everybody else didn't. And I was like, I don't know, how old was I in fifth grade? Whether, however, I noticed, like it was visible to the whole class that he went against what they were supposed to be. So that, I mean, I think that's a good thing to think about, is like the ways of calling out a different view of somebody.
Well, and it's how it stuck with you all these years.
Yeah.
That's powerful.
When I forget most of everything else. But yeah, it was powerful enough to remember.
I would add that the last lesson, the 20th lesson, this isn't really a spoiler, but is that the shortest lesson, and basically all it says on the page is, be as courageous as you can be.
Yeah.
You know, stand up when you can.
Yeah.
Take that stance.
Mm-hmm. It makes me think of the idea of giving kids a clean slate every day that they come to school, and oftentimes those troublemakers are not given a clean slate, and what's happened in the past comes with them. I think as teachers, it's important for us to give a clean slate as much as we can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, including sometimes like the siblings of the troublemaker. Like it becomes an entire family legacy of labeling from that as well. That's really important.
Mm-hmm. So I know you're all also advocators of books other than your professional books, and so we thought the next category we might talk about are anything that you don't have to be sharing with a book club, but that you might share with a book club, the kind of reading that is teaching you something or intellectually inspiring or challenging in some way, makes you want to talk with other people about it. So what's everybody reading that's on that shelf?
So Jesse and I are reading a book called Homecoming by Yaza.
Homegoing.
Which is why it's called Homegoing. Because it's a play on homecoming. And I am completely captivated by this book and actually have been talking about it. I can't help myself. And I'm interested in it for reasons that I'm usually not interested in a book. It has a really interesting structure. And structure usually isn't the thing that captures me. But she follows two families chronologically from pre-colonial Africa to the present day, and alternates families with chapters about individual people who are related generation by generation. The amazing thing with that complex structure so like chronological and back and forth, is that each story about the person is like a beautiful short story. They can almost stand on their own. They're all captivating. She does, so she sort of has this ability to really viscerally communicate the pain that colonialism and slavery inflicts on people. And at the same time show the incredible survival and resilience of the people to love and take care of each other. It's kind of incredible, all of the things that are going on in this book, and at the same time, like, hanging together so beautifully.
You finished the book, and I'm still in the middle of it. All the things you said, and just, it's one of those books that you reread paragraphs, because they're just so beautiful. The first paragraph of the book is, can I read it?
Yeah.
It's beautiful. The night Effia Acher was born into the musky heat of Conteland, a fire raged through the woods just outside her father's compound. It moved quickly, tearing a path for days. It lived off the air. It slept in caves and hidden trees. It burned up and through, unconcerned with what wreckage it left behind, until it reached an Asante village. There it disappeared, becoming one with the night. And I love that image of fire and what it leaves behind. It's such a beautiful metaphor for colonialism and the story of the book. It's a book about women and men, but there's something really powerful about the way she described women and their perspective and lens. It's really personal and intimate. I love it.
And the men. I mean, my favorite chapter is H, which is the name of a male character, who I feel like, wow, this guy has been through so much and, you know, keeps going, and these pretty horrible tragedies of minor happen, and then this little beautiful lucky thing happens. I don't know. Spoiler alert. You know, you want to hear the end now?
No.
The great thing about the structure is it isn't a playful thing. It isn't like, I'm going to have fun with structure. The structure is actually the sense of the book.
I was telling one of my meal tables that you had recommended it so strongly that I immediately wrote to my book group, and they listened to an interview with the author and were amazed at the interview with this author, and we immediately got it on the list. So please, no spoiler alerts. But when I mentioned what you had said about the book, people around the table started to talk about their reading of Underground Railroad.
Right.
Yes.
And so I was curious whether, and we had read that in book group as well, whether those were an interesting set of books to pair.
They are. They are an interesting set of books to pair. This book, if you believe me or not, is more ambitious and more successful in its ambition than even that great book.
Mm-hmm.
Which
wow.
is quite a recommendation, because I love Underground Railroad.
Yeah. I read Lincoln and the Bardo.
And Lincoln and the Bardo.
Yeah.
Before reading this book.
Me
and
too.
I think that
I read it right before.
We read all the things. But I think what's really interesting is that Lincoln and the Bardo is also a phenomenal book, and it also plays in such a powerful way with structure.
Yeah.
And
so that could be a nice set of three.
Good.
If people
three.
Haven't read all three of them,
yeah.
there's like resonance there. That's
yeah.
kind of cool.
And all about slavery and
yeah.
race.
Right. What else do people have?
Am I allowed to talk about a book that a book club I'm in might be talking about soon, but I just was blown away by it. And
yeah.
it hurt me in a beautiful way.
Yeah.
So have you guys heard of Laura Pritchett? She's
yeah.
local. She's a Colorado author, but she wrote a book called Stars Go Blue.
Mm.
And I haven't quite finished it yet, but it's about a couple. They're an older couple. And the story is told in alternating point of view chapters of the husband and the wife. They have split, and it's not a secret to say that they've split because of a bunch of things, but he is in the middle of Alzheimer's, and we are writing, we are seeing him realize that he is losing his mind. And he is remembering that his daughter was murdered, and he is discovering that the man who murdered his daughter, who was her husband, has just been released from prison. So he has decided that before he can't, he has to do this thing. He has to confront that guy. But he is struggling with this in the middle of losing his ability to be himself. I mean, it's delightfully told, and then his wife's counterpoint story is a story of her struggling with losing so many things, and it's just a simple, delightful, beautiful point-counterpoint of this story. I don't know how it ends, because I have not finished it, but it's the way
you're
that
like
she...
You're dangerous than Tom right now.
Yeah, right. I'm good. I'm safe. Actually, thematically so. I don't know how it ends. I don't have memory, but it's just so simply written and so delightful, and the area where they live, which is a ranch in Colorado, is such a part of the story that it's just... She is an engineer. He is a poet. It is it's just delightful.
You used the word delightful four times.
It's too. I did so.
Which is okay. You're allowed to repeat the word. I just.
I didn't think
because I was like
book.
Crying. Like this must be the saddest thing in the world.
I didn't think I was going to read this book, but it's so beautiful. And we were at the pool, and my kids are at an age where suddenly I am irrelevant at the pool. They can swim. They have siblings. There are things. There are lifeguards. I found myself with 5 hours to kill, and my wife said, handed me the book in a Ziploc bag to keep it from getting wet, and said, there you go. And I was just, in the middle of, like, being in the summer, I was suddenly in the story, and so good. And cool. So terrible. So good.
Cool. I would like to add to our list a book of poetry by Ada Limon, called Bright Dead Things, her newest book. And maybe not even my favorite Ada Limon book, but it's pretty amazing. And she's on my mind because we're here with some teachers from Lexington, Kentucky, who aren't in here with us today at this moment. But Limon splits her time between Northern California and Lexington, Kentucky. And this particular book of poetry has really evocative, beautiful descriptions of a person somewhat at sea in horse country at first, but really growing to love that place, and it's just beautiful.
I was thinking, I'm not sure if everybody listening would be interested in this book, but in a book group, we read a lot of books. And a book we read a little while ago, which is hard even to describe, is a book that has stuck with me so much. So, like, I want to name it because, not because it's great or because you want to reread paragraph after paragraph, but there's something, and maybe it's because of the political context now, that's sort of haunting about it. And it's called Last Night at the Lobster. Okay, so Julia has read it, and but you see why it's hard to imagine a pitch for this book. But do you think am I crazy to pitch this book?
No, I love this book.
So this book is the title does tell you what it's about, even though you're sitting there saying, "What does that title tell me?" Picture lobster as something like the Lobster Hut. The lobster,
Red Lobster,
Red Lobster it's a casual dining restaurant.
Chain restaurant, yeah.
And it is set the last night before the corporate closing and takeover and distribution of the workers, maybe to being fired and laid off, maybe to their sister properties. And it is about the last, I'm going to cry actually talking about the last night of this restaurant. And our main character is the incredibly decent, hardworking manager of this restaurant, and his caring about, but also issues with his employees, his desire to do right by them, in the midst of all the feelings about the closing, his complicated life, it all takes place in like about 6 hours, like from opening the restaurant to closing the restaurant. And it has this combination of just real people living sort of real lives in the midst of a life that is, you know, that where late corporate capitalism is all around you, but it's not so much about that as that is the, you see what it's like to live a life in that context. And these characters are in some ways haunting because it's like your brother-in-law, it's the guy down the street, you sort of know all of them, you've gone into the restaurant, you start thinking about the person who serves you, the guy behind the counter, all that kind of stuff. So it's all I can say is the plot's about the last night before they literally turn the lights off. But it's in its way a strangely deep book that hasn't left me for years.
I love that book. I would describe, I have described that book to other people as a love song to work.
To work.
And mm-hmm.
And the working classes and the decency mm-hmm. of work.
It's rendered with such love and respect for the people who populate it. I think it's and that's why it's unusual. There just is not a lot of fiction that feels true to the lives of working class people, I think. Not like from an outsider perspective, it feels very honest and insider to people who work for a living. I love that book.
Has anybody read La Rose?
Loved La Rose.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Ooh.
Talk about
She's
it.
Amazing. Was she, I mean, in Louise Erdick's book, typically something very terrible happens in the first few pages, and the rest of the book is about healing. But this is a really terrible thing, an accidental shooting of a neighbor's son. And they have to get past it. And it is full of Erdick characters all over the place. Also decent people trying to live their lives under difficult circumstances. Some funny, some tragic, some drug addicted. It's whenever she writes a book, you're in a whole world. But the progress of these two families trying to recover from this horrible accident, horrible, horrible accident, is just amazing. And I think she, I mean, I guess I like The Roundhouse a little better, but her work is better and better with every novel. And she's written a lot. And everybody loves Love Medicine, but it's way down on my list of best ones because she's better and better and better. And so my advice is don't quit reading after Love Medicine.
And of course it's set in the reservation.
Yep.
And so it's also the accident, the redemption, the healing, and also people whose lives are intertwined as relations and
yeah.
through history and that sort of thing. That's also a big part of the story.
Yep.
Yeah.
It goes back in history. But it's so true because it's like the stops and starts and backwards and forwards of healing. It isn't, mm-hmm. you know, this thing that's what feels real about it is like, thought things were going to get better and then they don't and then they do and then they move back a few steps. It's really, I mean, she's so good about, I mean, the characters in the book do not live lives like mine. But somehow I feel like I know them. Like I feel like it's easy to be in the book with them. Yeah, good book.
It makes me think about another book that I read this spring, Hillbilly Elegy,
yeah.
which a lot of people I've
been
talked
talking
to
about it all
been
week.
Talking about.
Yeah.
And that is a great book. It sparks so a really rich conversation and sometimes really difficult conversation, but incredibly relevant to our political context right now. And it's a memoir of a man growing up in Appalachia. Mm-hmm. And his story of growing up in poverty and working class conditions, and I don't know, from my perspective and research, it's really interesting the sponsors in his life that support him. Mm-hmm. His grandparents are incredible, difficult people, but are incredibly present in his life. And it's such a reminder to me of how we already know this, but just hearing that story of how just being there and being the people that that kids can fall back on. And he's telling the story of how he got out of his life, and so it's really controversial in a way. And I've had heated discussions at lunch on campus with colleagues who absolutely hated the book mm-hmm. and thought it was really offensive. And then yesterday at lunch, talking to writing project teachers who are from Kentucky who found it really interesting and mm-hmm. loved it and have used it in their teaching. And I think I texted Tanya because I was so upset about a conversation I had with colleagues over lunch. I couldn't understand their reaction to the book because it was so different than mine, which I think is actually what is such a gift. Mm-hmm. I think that's the whole point of reading and thinking and crossing those lines. But, and then Tanya, you had such a great response to it.
I've forgotten that we had that conversation, but yeah, we did. And I think I've been, like you, I've been talking to a lot of people this week who've read the book, and it's interesting to me that you, the other thing about a book is there's so many ways in or so many connections, and I'm listening to people, I'm like, that's not what I took from that book, you know? So I think one thing I like about that book and about him is no matter where you are on a sort of socio-political stance, he will challenge he challenges your thinking. Like, I know, if you're liberal, you think the answer to this problem is X, but let me tell you what that looked like on the ground in my community. And I know, if you are like a staunch Republican, and then you're going to think Y, but let me tell you, it's not as simple as that. And so he tells his own story. He doesn't try to answer the questions. He just sort of surfaced. I thought, I should be careful because I know, having listened to people all week, not everybody thinks this, but I didn't think that he tried to answer any questions. He rather surfaced them from his experience as a person who could talk across a lot of constituents who'd be interested in this issues that are connected to poverty and work and social supports.
Yeah, we read it in my book group, which was great because it was great to have a bunch of people be able to talk about it. And one of the things I keep thinking about this is to build on what you were saying, Tanya. He started to write the book as a memoir. He said this in a couple of his interviews, as a memoir. For the reasons that people write memoirs, to understand their life and how they got to be the person they are. He didn't write it to be a political treatise. He wrote it actually to write his way out of a very challenging and dysfunctional childhood that he found haunting him as an adult. And by the end of the book, you see, you know, like his wife is sort of saying, go figure your stuff out, you know, or whatever. And he goes and he writes to try and figure himself out, which is why a lot of people write memoir. But it happened to be published at the very moment when it could become the it book of the, of the campaign where, you know, those particular locations of coal country and displaced white working class and that sort of thing became issues everybody was talking about. So all of a sudden this book that starts as a memoir becomes a political argument that he didn't actually originally plan for it to tidily make policy prescriptions, and it doesn't tidily make policy prescriptions. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting kind of the text in its context kind of thing that happens.
That's the heated conversation we had was actually about the role of memoir, mm-hmm. and I just have this firm belief that like memoir is about putting your whole self forward and telling your story, whatever that story is, and how it reaches people is different depending how we take it up and the context. and the political situation and all that. But the people who I was having a conversation with felt like the problem with it is that he's trying to represent a people, and that you can't, that it's not fair to represent a people. And I was like, no, he's just telling his story. So anyway, it was a really interesting...
Both and, maybe.
It's both and, yeah.
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 I'd like to share a book kind of along the same lines that Jesse brought up in terms of the importance of having mentors in your life. And the book that I'm reading is called An Invisible Thread. It's about a New York executive who often walks down the street taking the subway. And as you know, in New York City, there's lots of panhandlers and people begging for various things. And on this particular day, this woman walks down the street and she passes this young man who's asking for money, and she makes it to the corner, and when she gets to the corner, something compels her to turn around, and she walks back and has a conversation with this boy and finds out that he's very hungry and offers to take him to McDonald's and feeds him and sends him off on his way, promising that she'll do the same thing the next Monday if he feels like he's hungry. And sure enough, many Mondays go by and they have these dinners together and they get to know each other and they become friends, and it's the story of their relationship and what happens and how it evolves, and really the role of mentor comes into play a lot, and just giving this child who you learn to discover the rest of his life is in shambles, and she's really this one rock that he has, and you see how he comes back to her.
Fiction or
nonfiction? It's nonfiction.
Wow.
Yeah.
The Invisible, say the title again?
An Invisible Thread. Huh. And it's written by Alex Tresniowski and Laura Schroff. It's from Laura's perspective, first person story. And it's a compelling story, I think, for anybody, but in particular teachers who work with students who come from diverse backgrounds, and especially in one situation in the story, he comes to her, the main boy in the story is named Maurice. Maurice comes to Laura and says, we're having a parent night at my school. Will you come with me? And her response is, you know, we need to check in with your mom first. And there's a lot of backstory that happens along with that. And it's very interesting, and I'm enjoying it immensely.
Cool. Yeah.
I can't help but think how that ties into how we started this whole conversation with courage. And, you know, courage on her part to step out of her regular routine and do her thing, and then courage on the boy's part to, or it was a boy? Mm-hmm. Or, yeah, to ask for help and to be open to stepping outside of what his trajectory was or is. And it's an interesting thread from the beginning of this conversation to that piece.
Very interesting turn of reading, and also kind of a lot of heavy.
Crazy heavy.
We haven't gotten to the beach reading category,
it
really.
It seems like maybe we should turn our attention to your vacation reading. What are you taking to the beach? Or what's light?
Can I give you two real quick?
Of course.
So I was really excited to discover that a series that I thought was a trilogy is no longer a trilogy because the fourth book just came out.
Ooh.
And it's an older series. It's by a guy named Scott Meyer who does an online comic, but it's called Off to Be the Wizard is the first book. I think it's called Magic 2.0 is the series. The premise of the book is, do any of you know it? Oh, I mean, this is way on the other end of the spectrum from stuff we've been talking about. The premise is that this guy, he's a computer nerd, shockingly, and he discovers that a spreadsheet that might actually be controlling reality, so he can change attributes in the spreadsheet and things change. And so basically he's discovered that the entire world is the Matrix, and he has figured out how to make it work. So his immediate reaction is to try to get rich, and the cops immediately come for him, and he runs to King Arthur's England, and thinking he will be Merlin, and he can live there because he can control the universe. And he discovers 30 or 40 other guys who also discovered the database and have done the same thing. And it sounds stupid, but it's delightful, and it's light, and it's funny, and it's interesting, and you can read them in a hurry, which I think is a good beach criteria.
All beach qualities.
And, right. And along the same lines, the there's a guy named, what's the name? Hang on. This is really good radio. Dennis Taylor wrote a book called We Are Legion, We Are Bob, which Amazon has started pumping because it was a self-published thing that they turned. And this is more hard science, but it's about a guy who cryogenically frees himself or prepares to have himself frozen and then is hit by a car about 20 minutes later. And he wakes up. Told you, it's the other end of the spectrum. But he wakes up 200 years later to discover that he's the property of a nation and he's being turned into a von Neumann probe. The von Neumann probe is I know it's nerdy, guys, but it's really good. The whole idea here is that von Neumann probe is a self-replicating probe, so it goes out to explore the galaxy, create resources, and make a copy of itself. Now there's two, now there's four, and think 3D printers, but really fancy. Right?
Got it. Yeah.
And so it's a story of what happens when, like, the world decides that that's a thing, and how do you solve these scientific things, and what's discovered. So it's a little bit discovery, it's a little bit engineering, it's a little bit science. A lot of fun. It does not take much to get into it, and then it's horribly addicting because it's very serialized. So if you like The Martian, right?
Yeah.
This is a series of problems that are lower stakes.
Yeah.
Much lower. Well, I mean, the history of the future of the human race at some point is in question.
Yeah.
But it's still beach reading, and the Amazon versions are quite good, and it's a trilogy as well, and the third one will be released on August 8th, and I'm a little excited about that.
Ooh.
You are about the serialized version.
I didn't mean to be.
No, that's awesome.
But
that's fine.
So there were seven books, and I only had to talk about two of them.
Wow.
So I usually don't read beach stuff, and I wasn't intending to because this is by Chris Habani, who is on our writer's council, isn't he?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh, yeah.
All right. And he's written a book called Graceland, which is like an amazing book, not for the beach, but really a great book. So I read another book by him, The Secret History of Las Vegas, which is a detective story. The suspects are conjoined twins.
That's not funny.
Welcome to my side.
And there's an ecological thriller sort of thread through it, and it goes back and forth between South Africa and Las Vegas.
Wow.
And that's really all you need to know. And you should do it.
It's just going on my list. I'm telling
yeah.
you.
It's done.
Is it creepy?
Yeah. But it's also like so crazy that it's also very funny.
So it works.
Yeah, it works.
That is
because
so
like
nice.
There's no criteria.
I think it works. I think it sounds great.
So awesome.
Can I do one more just because I will go fast?
You go. You go.
Mostly so that I can introduce the idea that Balky from Perfect Strangers is my favorite audiobook narrator ever. Right?
I can see that.
So he actually is not that voice, but Bronson Pinchot narrates a ton of audiobooks. That's what he's done. And he's done a ton of different genres and a ton of different things. But he narrated A Man on the Moon, The Voyages of the Apollo Astronauts, which is Andrew Shaken is a space historian. Tom Hanks read the book to prep for Apollo 13, was so inspired by it. He did that series on HBO, To the Moon, because he's like, there's so many good stories here, we have to tell them. So it's just a history of the Apollo program from start to finish, but you can listen to it in nice little chunks, and you learn these delightful facts about how hard it was to get scientists on these missions and how big a deal it was and how the way that they did was the geologists started like recruiting astronauts and they're just walking up to him on the street and saying, can I talk to you about rocks? And by the end of it, like Jim Lovell is running a room of scientists and astronauts across the... Oh yeah, I do. I'm wearing my NASA shirt today. Because I'm a nerd. But by the end of it, they're all cheerleading for things. And it's a book about how geology teaches you to pay attention to things and how astronaut. It's just a great read and a good listen, and so is pretty much everything else that Bronson Pinchot has ever narrated.
I can believe that, but I didn't know it, so that's exciting.
Including a series of vampire detective novels, but that's another conversation.
Buzz on the roll.
I might want to read.
The President's Vampire, look it up.
It wasn't until really within the last year that I ever listened to an audiobook. I just hadn't my whole life. And had this didn't particularly want to, even though I have friends who really, really recommended them. And the first one I listened to was really quite wonderful, and a different way of interacting with a book. Like, I really experienced the book differently. There were some things I felt like I was sad to have lost, but then things that felt richer, and it made me get interested in audiobooks. I don't know whether people have recommendations, but what you were saying seemed to be really true, that some are great as audiobooks and well-performed and well-read, and others are terrible. So I don't know if anyone around the table has any audiobook recommendations.
My experience is nonfiction is better than fiction.
Agreed.
Why do you think that is? Or, like, what is that for you?
Like what Jesse said about rereading sentences.
Oh, yeah. I can see that.
And keeping track of characters if you have to flip back.
Yeah.
It's easier.
But somehow, with nonfiction, it tells you that.
I used to agree with that.
Yeah.
I would only listen to nonfiction. And then I found out that the narrator really can alter the way. Yeah, and I've had arguments with people about whether or not this is an interpretive reading or whatever, get away from authorial intent. I'm like, well, I don't care.
Yeah,
because what you talked about, like keeping track of characters, I'm not talking about overdone voices, right? Just like
right.
Faulkner can get away with writing Southern dialects. He did it so well, but most people who try it, it's a terrible idea and they shouldn't bother. But good narrators can do these subtle things that allow you to keep track of lots of different people and lots of different ideas. Siri makes it very easy to go back and rehear things. The Audible app has the great 10-second, go back 10 second, go back 10 second, and do. What?
We love your music.
Oh, thank you. I'm sorry. I also have a very good friend who listens to audiobooks at double speed, which I think is too fast, but I have noticed that you can, if you listen to enough, I'm up at 1.25 and 1.5 speed.
That's why here's the ideal.
And it's getting pretty good. It's getting pretty interesting. It's changing the way I take in stuff, and I love it. And I'm
also going to vote for fiction and audiobooks. I've listened to two in the last couple of years that I loved. The Lacuna by Barbara Kingsolver, an audiobook. I was driving and... I missed my exit sort of thing. I was in the book so much, and I can't remember who did the reading, but she was great at changing her voice for all the characters, and it just really pulled me in. And then the Outlander series, the Outlander book, I read on audiobook going down to Atlanta in November and back, and again, just drew me in so that I'm on the fifth book now, and I can't wait for the next one. So I don't know how much I want to talk about those, but you either sort of love the Outlander series or don't, from what I've heard, is that some people just can't get into it. But I love the time travel, historical, romance, spirituality, herbal medicine. There's just so many different layers to it that I just kind of go, yeah, I can buy this. So.
Could go back in the beach category. Could definitely take those books to the beach.
So I think I just feel compelled to offer this other beach book mostly in response to the idea that we should read at 1.5 speed. I'm not liking that idea. So I am offering a book which will make Elise laugh that I'm offering. This book is called Birds, Art, Life. A Year of Observation, and the author is, her name is K-Y-O McClear. She is she's from Toronto, and I know I decided I couldn't say that word, Toronto. She's from Toronto, and the book is about a sort of response to a very difficult year in her life where she, in a way, drops out of a lot of things and lets a lot of things go, and hooks up with an artist whose work she just happens upon, and takes photographs of birds in urban settings, and they're so interesting and compelling to her that she gets him to agree to let her follow him around for a year, and he takes her bird watching, and she learns to identify birds, but mostly she kind of creates an argument for her own life of small things and the value of a small vision. And it's really lovely. And I always will laugh because I'm terrified of birds. I hate birds, and that I'm compelled to figure out why other people like them. So
all this is true.
And it's
driven
and
to read
thing,
about birds by
by my fear of them.
Also courageous.
So
the Audubon field guide that I was getting you for summertime, not
no,
in book form, it's great.
It would be the live version.
The other thing about bird art life, for the reason it's a great beach book, is this: it's very tiny chapters. Like, so you can just read a little snippet here and there whenever you feel compelled.
I'm reading to my kids.
Nice.
E.B. White's The Jupiter Swan. Is that what it is? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really short chapters because it's a kid's book. And it was one of my favorite books growing up. I love animals. My kids love animals. And I just want to make a plug for parents reading books that they loved to their kids.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's a bad thing. Like, I started reading Little House on the Prairie to my daughter, and I loved Little House on the Prairie, and she found it so boring and tedious. And other kids her age love it. And I was like, oh, this is a bummer. Like, she's not feeling it in the same way that I felt it.
Also, did you find it a different experience?
I found it really boring.
I found it, like...
And kind of disturbing.
Yeah, really. Racially offensive. Like, oh!
Yeah, I had that same thing happen with one of my favorite books of all time. What's the one with the little girl who's the boy? Is the Secret Garden.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Majorly disturbing rape stuff in that book.
I haven't reread that one.
But it's this beautiful, wonderful story. So I found myself skipping while I read some of the paragraphs that were... problematic, which I don't know.
I think that's a great point, though, like going back to childhood or things you loved as a kid. I think it's so important not to just by default roll into that with your own children, you know, and just because it was considered a classic 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago, maybe it still is, but maybe it's time to, like, freshen up the, and let those.
And I totally freshened up, but then there's something so wonderful when it clicks, when they fall in love with a book they loved, and The Term of the Swan is one of those. It's just sweet, and I don't know.
And an experience was kind of the flip of that. I was recently at an event where a local bookstore was selling children's books, and I picked up this graphic novel called Fish Girl, and I started reading through it thinking it was just going to be a sweet narrative story about a girl living in the ocean. And I found it quite disturbing. It dealt with some serious topics of child imprisonment and just this main character who is put in a position where she has to essentially work for food and stories and games. And it left me with a very unsettled feeling and wondering who the intended audience was, and really, really wanting to be able to discuss it with another adult to see their take
mm-hmm.
on the story. And I have yet to find somebody who's read it, so if any of you get your hands on it, I'd be very curious to hear your take.
Looks interesting.
Yeah.
There's it made me think of Nimona, right? The graphic book that's looks like it could be for very young kids, but maybe really isn't when you actually start getting into it and looking at it. And it's illusory sometimes. We think that the illustrated stuff is
mm-hmm.
more kid-friendly, but it turns out maybe it's not.
It's been really neat discovering. There's a whole new, really hot-off-the-press section of books that are like graphic novels for kids, but for really early readers.
Yep.
There's this one series called Owl Diary,
mm-hmm.
and my kids
love
it. It's so
love
sweet.
That too.
And it's perfect for when you get past those like beginning readers, Scholastic 1, 2, Level 3, but you're not quite ready for the chapter books.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really sweet, and they capture kids' attention, and they also have the images. And they do all the things more sophisticated graphic novels do, but they're perfect for early readers.
And I love the Raina Telgemeier, books. She has a number of them.
Smile and Sisters.
Yeah,
and, she's doing the Babysitter's Club.
Yes.
The Babysitter's Club, you guys, is back as graphic novels.
Yeah, they love those books.
What?
Did she do drama too?
Yeah, I think so.
She did drama.
And then her most recent Ghost, which deals with a lot of big topics.
That one's heavier. Mm-hmm. I mean, way heavier. Yeah. We did not let my kids have that one right away at the house. Mm-hmm. Usually those come right home. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my 12-year-old, like, ever since she could read, plowed through chapter books and loved that and never got into the graphic novels. But my 9-year-old, she's totally into the Smile.
Yeah.
And it's kind of at that level, too, and she just got, you know, braces maybe a year ago or whatever. And that's what attracted. She saw the picture of the Smiley with the braces, and she was like, oh, this is interesting. And then she got into it, and now she's, like, just a graphic novel girl. But lots of cool options out there now that I don't remember having as a kid, for sure. But.
My wife brought home Inside Out and Back Again by, I think it's Donna Lai, for us to read as an evening book, which I love because it's poems, so they're short. But it's poems about a refugee family in Vietnam. And there's kind of some heavy stuff that pops in and out, but what's worked out really well is that my younger daughter just likes being in the room, and my older daughters are asking some questions later. And it's beautiful. The language is beautiful. We're really enjoying it. And it's good that it's poems, because in summer, sometimes we go days between readings.
Yeah.
And we can come back in, and it's an easy, you know. But I would recommend it.
So a book I guess I can't recommend because I haven't yet read it, but it just was reviewed, I think, in the Times. But what you were saying about evening reading made me think of it, called The Social Life of Books. Did any of you see that book review? It's a historian, a literacy historian, and it's about a period through the 1800s especially, where almost everyone's encounters with books were in reading aloud settings, and for a lot of reasons. Books are expensive, optometry is such that a lot of people just actually could read the print, etc. So it looks at the wide range from the review, again, not having read it yet, of book clubs and settings where the major social event was someone reading a book aloud, and thinks about, you know, the difference, what it means to have taken away that social context. And then, of course, we all have books, then moves into the books, the private library, the notion that the book is now the solitary thing that you do sort of in your bedroom or in your library, or don't go into the library, dad's reading or mom's reading or something like that. Kind of the untangling of that social piece, and then to an even smaller social piece, like I know I do. I read a lot of books on my iPad or even now my iPhone, so I'm even like more into this little curled up position with my book than even if somebody could look over my shoulder and say, oh, I know that book. I see the cover. I read that. So it sounds like it's an interesting thing to read, to consider around reading aloud.
Yeah, we've been resurrecting that tradition in my house. And I'm going to do the thing we talked about not doing, but I can't remember the name of the book. But it's the Neil Gaiman short stories book that came out. And they're short, you know, so they're a few pages long. But my wife and I went to the beach, and we just read stories out loud to each other. And it was, like, so different of an experience. A, actual beach reading. But, so I'm looking at the... I was looking at the list of books to see if I can... It could spur my memory, but that social reading aspect, such a different level of experiencing text and stories and social time with people you like or don't like, maybe. But
we were just doing that on a road trip too. Reading in the car if you can.
Yeah.
That's so good for some people. I hate to say that. I think we're very close to the end of an hour. And, Tom, it looks like you need to say one more book.
I was thinking of Dragons Love Tacos.
Oh,
that book is so good!
And there's a sequel.
Dragons Love Tacos 2.
We actually had a party, and my husband created a giant piñata.
Yeah.
That was a taco.
That's excellent.
And we all read the book and had tacos.
Yeah, it's a great...
Talk about the book.
So they don't like spicy sauce. And they love parties. So if you have a party, make sure you have pantloads of tacos.
Pantloads of tacos.
But no spicy sauce.
But it's, I mean, it's a picture book.
It's a